The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask those present, please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we are discussing Step 4, Part 2. Last week, we had a lot of fun with resentments, as we often do. And so tonight, we're going to cover the other parts of the inventory on the topics of fear and sex. So, on that note, help me welcome our panel tonight. We've got Greg A., our sitting DCM for the city of great city of Norfolk, and Jill S. is a home group member here. Please. Okay, so step 4 says, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We're going to start out on page 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Jill, would you like to start?
Sure. Thanks. I'm Jill, an alcoholic.
Thank you, Jill.
And my sobriety date is November 10th, 1996, and this is my home group, Simple Actions. And I have to realize about the whole inventory process. It isn't so that I can dig up every bad thing I ever did and feel bad about it. It's to help me to find the truth about what put a drink in my hand over and over and over when it really looked like a bad idea to drink. And I didn't realize that fear, what big part fear plays in this. In this sentence when it says it's the evil and corroding thread. And corrosion is, it starts from the inside and eats me from the inside out. And it sets in motion every character defect I have. And when I'm looking at my fear, I have to get a little bit more honest about it. It's, you know, like I'm not afraid of heights. I'm not afraid of rats or snakes. Mine are self-centered fears. And when I have them, I'm going to act on one of my character defects. My self-centered fears are something like, it's never enough. I'm not good enough. I might lose something I have or not get something I need. So I set in motion all kinds of stuff. And when I do that, I don't do it intentionally. I don't do it because I'm a bad person. It's my knee-jerk reaction to my life. And in here, when they say our fabric of our existence is shot through with it, I look at, in step one in the step book, it talks about alcohol becomes a rapacious creditor, leading us of all self-sufficiency. Well, that's what fear does too. Rapacious just means it feeds on itself. And once I have fear in me, it doesn't stop. It just grows and grows and grows. And so that the sentence that says the evil encroaching, our fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It sets in motion trains of circumstances. If I wasn't so afraid of everything, or not having something, or not getting something, or not being enough, I wouldn't have something to act on. But so I act on it, and it sets in motion things I don't intend to happen. And when that happens like that for me, the only thing that quieted that down after a while was to belt down a few, you know, because it's like, that's too much, you know. The fear is just running rampant. I'm doing things that I'm that are upsetting me. You know, it can be relationships, which is really a big one in my cases. It's really kind of goofy to say, but sexually is closely related. Fear is really closely related to sex. It is, whoa, right on target. But if I'm fearful of something, I feel like I've got to act out in some way or act on something that I really don't. But we'll talk more of that in a moment. It's like, in my relationships, am I acting out of a conscious belief or something, a conscious ideal, or am I reacting to a fear? And unfortunately for me, most of the time I'm reacting to a fear. And so when they say it's a short word that touches just about every aspect of my life, it took me a long time to get honest about a lot of those fears. And a lot of times to get honest about how they manifest in my inventory. Because if you had asked me when I got here what I was afraid of, I would have said nothing. I'm one tough rod. And that's not true. Thanks, that's all I have.
Thanks, Jill.
Thanks.
Greg? Hi, my name is Greg, and I am definitely an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 5th, 1995, and my home group is Saturday Night Live. And kind of humorous, I was asked to do fear and sex, which are probably the two worst parts of my my history. When I read this section of the book, I really didn't understand what fear was. And, you know, life was, I felt that I was in the driver's seat of life through my entire drinking career. And I didn't realize until I took this step. And the first time I took the step, I was handed the book and my sponsor said, read this and do this. And my first fourth step was pretty sparse. It wasn't until he actually sat with me the second time I did it and, you know, kind of explained what all of this meant, because I was self-will. I had no clue. It was, I thought that I knew everything, and I didn't know how much fear had riddled my life. And it talks about fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife. And when you actually look at it, sex relations, self-esteem, self relations, security, personal relationships, and pride. And I really didn't understand how much my life was motivated by fear. And for my exercise, once I had that revelation, and it took time for me to have that revelation that I actually, you know, I could understand it up here in my head, but I had trouble understanding it here in my heart. And it wasn't until I was at a point in my sobriety where I thought that I was going to go out and drink that my sponsor reeled me back in, and we did this, you know, one line at a time and went through it. And that fear, corrosive thread, but, you know, sometimes it's also a great motivator. You know, I had no desire to go back to the person that I was. And so that was my primary motivation. But the second inventory, I was told to sit down by myself and just write out every single little fear that I had in life, from the time that I was a small child up until now. And, you know, kind of graphing that out and looking and seeing how those things motivated the way that I acted. In the paragraph it says, it was an evil corroding thread, the fabric of our resistance was shot through it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? And I was able to look back and see fear of having a conversation with somebody and that relationship turning bad and going, wow, you know what? I did have a part in that. So it really brought, you know, the first part of the fourth step into better clarity for me, because I was able to see what my part really was. And, you know, when I first did it, I was thinking, oh yeah, they did bad things to me, and yeah, it might have caused some friction, but it wasn't until I actually really looked at fear and compared it to my columns where I could see how motivated or dismotivated I was by fear and how it caused problems. Today in sobriety, I sometimes still have those fears come on. One specific, you know, working with a boss. He could go on my fourth step. He's a jerk. He's not nice. You know, all those things that go through my head. And the fear of actually going and asking God for help to get through that fear, to have that conversation that I need to have with this person. So for me, that's what this really drew out. Stealing, it's worse than stealing, because I realized how much of my life, how many things that I missed in life, many opportunities that I missed. One, because of my alcoholism, but two, because of my fear. You know, as a young person, I can go back and remember having all these grand ideas and plans that didn't happen because of my fear. Things that were within my reach. Gratefully, I don't have to live that way because of this step and because of my reliance on God.
Thanks, Greg. Okay, we're going to pick up on page 68. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Jill?
Okay. This is, when I'm thinking about my fears, it's because I'm running on my own self-will. You know, I'm going to conquer this. And my will, it's, I've written something down, I'm going to read it to you, because it's something I wrote early, way long time ago, and I just found it a few days ago. It says, defective desires lead to death. And I thought, well, surely you're not going to die from these defects. This was what was really neat about it. There's always death of something. It's death of my character, death of my self-respect, and the separation of man and God. I'm ruled by my will, which is fueled by my self-centered fear. So when I'm running on self-will, I'm always going to default to my defects of character. And when they take hold and they start running my life, I'm not only separating myself from you, I'm separating myself from God. The only thing that's given me any relief from myself. You know, if I'm not seeking God, then I'm going to rely on my own will. And when I do that, I get terrified of whatever. You know, whether it's being afraid, whether it's whether or not you like me, or if I'm enough or not enough. I mean, it's either good or bad. I'll take either one. It drives me nuts sometimes because I don't have even a clear-cut vision sometimes of being too good or too bad. I'll take either one. But I had a problem for a long time. I thought, I grew up, but this is an old idea, and it's really a self-defeating idea, that all real people pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and they conquer their lives. You know, I'm a scrappy fighter. That's why I always told myself, I'm really not. I've never been a good fighter. You know, I'm like the puppy that gets kicked one too many times. You know, sooner or later, I just roll over, and if you rub my belly, I'll do anything. So, you know, I want to say I'm this, this, and this, but I'm not, you know, and I spent so much time pretending to be what I'm not. And when I get that terrified of something, if this is what this program is so great about, I've got a sponsor that I can tell anything to. And that can be gentle when the situation calls to be gentle, can be firm when the situation can be firm, can be downright mean when the situation says, oh, come on, snap out of it. We've talked about this a million times. It's like to point out my fallacies of thinking, you know, that I'm too good or not good enough. You know, I'm such a contradiction when it comes to that stuff. But they say, paradoxically, it was a way of strength. When I will rely on this program and prayer, meditation, talking to a sponsor, doing the inventory, because I have to write it down in black and white. Otherwise, if I try to think it through in my head, you know, I'm going to terrify myself. For years, I was, this was a big revelation in AA. For years, I suffered from terrible nightmares, horrible nightmares, gut-wrenching nightmares. And finally, in the program, and after I'd done enough inventory, I realized none of that ever happened. It was my thinking. I was scaring myself to death. And if you gave me a night of drinking, I'd go to bed with that head. And of course you're going to have nightmares. I mean, some of the stuff that's running around up there is scary. But it was just like I would do it to myself. And when I saw that all of this was self-generated, I thought, why am I so insistent on relying on myself to conquer whatever, you know, whether it's my fear or whatever I'm trying to conquer. It's like that's got to be one of the dumbest ideas I ever came up with, but I hang on to it. I still hang on to it today, which is a little bit scary. But the best sentence in here, and this is a prayer, by the way, I ask God to remove my fear and direct my attention to what He would have me be. Not what He would have me say or think or do. What would you have me be? And then I commence to outgrow fear. I don't outgrow it for good. It's like a stopgap for me. It's there to keep me, to make me realize that I don't ever graduate from fear. I don't graduate from this program. It's there to stop me sometimes. Will you stop? Just stop. Because if I get going full bore, nothing stops me. I'm just like a Tasmanian devil at times. And so I don't get to get the courage. I get what courage I need just for today. I get whatever fear I need just for the moment. And then I realize that strength doesn't come from me. It comes from me getting on my knees, praying, doing the inventory, surrendering to something greater than me. And early on, that was these rooms, the people, my sponsor. And that arena has enlarged today, but it doesn't go away. And it's good that it doesn't go away. Because I said this in a meeting the other day, if I really got well tomorrow, I'd take credit for it. And then we'd be off to the races again. I have no doubt about that, because I love to take credit for things. I like to brag. But up here, we trust God. And when I first got here, that was a real problem for me because I said, I don't believe in God. How can I trust something I don't believe in? Well, do you believe this program? Yeah. Do you believe that I'm telling you the truth? Yeah. Okay, well, you believe in that for just now. And that enlarges and grows. And I've gotten today I have a real conviction about what I believe in. And I'm not here to sell anyone on that, but I'm here to say that it's grown as a result of doing this stuff. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim. Greg?
What I wanted to start with was we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. And one of my big fears was I had a lot of shame about the concept of God. And I grew up up until the age of 9, my family was Catholic, and then half of them became Southern Baptist. And so by the age of 16, I gave up on God. And I was actually, I could understand the concept of relying on a power greater than myself. But I felt ashamed, and I didn't want people to know that about me. Because I had prejudice against religion or even spiritual concepts, and I didn't want people to have those same prejudices or judgments that I had against other people having them against me. And so I kept my relationship with my higher power to myself. And it wasn't until I was able to invite God into that and to help release me from that fear. I hear this in meetings, fear of what other people think of me. I was afraid. I was afraid of what you thought of me. Am I not good enough? Am I too good? You know, my view of myself was always skewed. And so for me, that was a big stepping point was, getting to that point, being comfortable enough in a power greater than myself, to feel okay about letting other people know. And it's interesting because once that switch happened, I'll talk freely about, believing in a higher power, and I choose to call that God. And people that I speak with will immediately jump to, oh, which church do you go to? Or which faith do you follow? And I say it's one personal to me. So I had to get past that fear. In the paragraph right above it, one of my favorite lines is, we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. And for the longest time, I thought that I was infinite. I thought that everything, single thing that happened in my life was because I wanted it bad enough. And if I didn't get it, I told myself that I really didn't want it. And so when, that switch happened and, I came to believe that God was this infinite power and I'm just finite, I can only do what's right in front of me, then it really made it different. We're in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly, rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? And what was really cool is, once this became an embraced part of my AA program, I now had a job. I just needed to, I thought I had this job that gave me a paycheck, but I have this other job now, and the job is to be of maximum service. And, life, when I'm on that AA beam and that's the core of me, wow, life is amazing. And matching calamity with serenity, I can remember times in my sobriety where everything, and I mean everything in my life, was falling apart. And I was okay because I believe that God is going to take care of me. Tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., I'm having surgery. And everybody's like, are you afraid? Are you afraid? I'm not. I'm going to go in there and God's going to take care of me. I believe that in my soul. And that's the awesome thing about this. The things that I used to think were calamity are just, you know, different branches of the path that God wants me to follow. So I'm very grateful, and I love that line. And then at the end of that paragraph that David read, instead we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. And when I'm focusing on that, the most dangerous place for me is by myself, right here between my ears. But if I'm actually doing something, and my first sponsor was funny because, you know, he would have me do weird things like weed his garden. And I'm like, this is insane, but I was desperate enough to do it. What I didn't realize was he was giving me a task to focus on. And if I'm focused on the task at hand, none of that other stuff is rattling around in my head. It's just when I'm left to my own devices and then I'm sitting there and it's going over and over. And so the nights that I start thinking about the things that make me afraid, I ask God to help me. And he does. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we're going to continue on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. We find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we don't have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare. The other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiters of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Jill?
Okay. You know, I think back about sex relationships, and I think back on the phrase I told my sponsor one time, and I wasn't trying to be smart or glib, but I said, you know, if I wasn't charming them or sleeping with them, I didn't know what to do with them, you know? It's like I got this idea about relationships, and really sex was just a byproduct of it. You know, it's like, most of my relationships, where I'm trying to secure myself or where I'm trying to make myself feel better, just throw sex at it, you know? And it's like, when they say we needed an overhaul, I need an overhaul. And what do I believe about this part of my relationships? You know, and instead of being all embarrassed and going, oh my God, we're going to talk about sex. You know, I was a 60s and 70s kid. I didn't, you know, that was all we did. And that's all we talked about. We were very upfront about it. But we really weren't. It was an activity. It was not an ideal. And I really got off track with that because it was like I didn't give any more consideration or thought about that area of my life than I did about what pair of shoes I was going to wear that day. You know, it didn't mean anything to me. It was like more like a recreational sport, you know. It's just, and so I didn't have a lot. I tell people a lot of times when I got here, I was so dead inside, and a lot of it was the way I behaved, the way I thought about things, the way I didn't think about things. I didn't think about them. You know, if you're not thinking about it, how can you be bothered by it, right? What makes you really callous? And that's what I was. I was very callous and just, well, what does it mean? And I can remember being in, I was married twice. And my first marriage, my husband and we both got in a lot of trouble because we started dating other people. And so that blew up. So the next one, I'm married to a fine person. And he always said, you know, you give everybody everything except for what they really need. And I thought, what the heck is he talking about? But I never asked him. It was so mechanical. Everything I did was so mechanical. So this is a big deal because it really has to do with relationships. Sex is a byproduct of it. It really has to do with if I look at it, how am I expressing it? Do I put any more value on that part of my life than I do on a new pair of shoes, you know? And unfortunately, I didn't. And it was funny. It was like I had written down earlier, I was very easily manipulated because I was running on self-will and feelings my whole time. And so a kind word or flattery turns my head from the facts. You know, I didn't look at the facts about what was going on or what it meant or what it should mean. It didn't register at all with me. So I'm just going to save what I got for later. I'll tell you a little bit more about it. Thanks.
Greg?
Straight pepper diet. All right. That's what I thought I was having, straight pepper diet. For me, I had my first drink when I was 9. I also got diagnosed with diabetes, and looking back on it, you know, hindsight is 20/20. It was at that moment in my life when I wanted to grow up and I didn't want to be a kid anymore. And I knew that adults drank, smoked, and had sex. And so those were the three things that I started having when I was 9. And I was very indiscriminate about it. It didn't mean anything to me. It meant a way for me to get out of who I was at the time. And that colored my entire drinking career. And what's interesting is I put no value on it from somebody else's standpoint. I only put a value on it from what I wanted. You know, that self-centeredness to the extreme. I would hold people hostage with it. I would deny it. It felt like something that I could control in my life. And I used it. And I used it to make people happy, make people sad, make people angry. It was just another tool in my repertoire of devaluing other people. And looking back on it, today I don't get into judgment on how other people live their lives, whether it's sex-based or not. I need to focus on how I'm using that aspect of myself. Am I using it selfishly? And when I went back to my fourth step list, there are quite a few people on there that I had intimate relations with. And that was part of that piece. And it was fear. If I could draw you in and keep you with that aspect of it, then I had the upper hand. And it's an interesting thing when I do my story. I never lost a relationship behind alcohol, because when I was done with you, I was done with you. You know, I didn't give it the time to lose the relationship behind alcohol. And, you know, I will go further when we get into the next couple of paragraphs about some of the things that I've learned about myself. And, you know, it says that it's God-given. And neither to be...
despised and loved.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's where I am on it. I used it as a tool. I used it as a tool, and I don't regret it today, because it brought me to where I am today, where I have a healthy sexual relationship with another human being, as opposed to the relationships that I had before. And that's what I have.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to continue on page 69. We reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Jill?
Okay, it's interesting. The first sentence was talks about our conduct. So right here is where I can kind of separate that. It's my conduct. Whether I'm, the thing that I didn't realize about sex is, okay, we know about the physical act of sex, but okay, I'm in the office, and I want to get something, get my way in a situation. So I have been known to flirt with people, get somebody on my side, to listen to my tale of woe because I need somebody to make me feel better. I'm not having sex with them, but I am. In my mind, this is a sexual situation. And so I have to realize that if I'm using my sexuality to get something, talk my way out of a ticket, to get a choice job in the office, to get someone on my side, or when I'm just feeling down and I need to feel better, am I going to go fishing for compliments from some guy and not taking into consideration one bit what that might be doing to the other person? I have a need, you know? And so when I look at this, the next one is being inconsiderate. I never thought what this was doing. When I'm flirting with someone at work, and this was something that really bothered me for a long time because I did it so much, it sounds pretty harmless. But I'm getting somebody kind of thinking about, you know, she's cute. Well, I used to be. I was young and very preppy. And I'd flirt with these guys, and they would get them right there where they're just thinking I'm like a cupcake. And they go home to a wife that's been with their four kids all day. She don't look like a cupcake. Some in the office is showing me a lot of attention. So when I really want to start thinking about what I'm doing, why would I do that? Because I don't think about you at all. I think about me. And that's where I'm being inconsiderate. You know, I just don't think how my actions play out in other people's lives. For the longest time, it didn't bother me. You know, if you don't think about it, it doesn't bother you a whole lot. But when you start doing this inventory, you got to start thinking about it. Or not. I mean, you can get medicated. But the next part is, did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? Those are tools. I don't know if any of y'all need to keep guys in line, but boy, that's a great way to try to keep people in line. Just throw a little jealousy out there, you know? Tell them something they don't really need to know. Tell me you flirted with somebody in the office and they thought you were cute. That's so inconsiderate, again, but it's worse than that. It's cruel. There's a part of that that just is better if you could just walk up and smack someone than to put that kind of notion in someone's head that they can't trust you anymore. You know, what is a marriage supposed to be built on? It's supposed to be built on trust. So if you're I remember one night I was flirting with someone, one of my husband's friends, of all things, and I remember my husband getting so mad. And I thought, well, isn't he a jerk? I didn't do anything wrong. Well, can you imagine going to bed with that in your head? What else has she done? You know? That's kind of, so this isn't, I'm not here to do a fifth step. But what I've got to say is I work at a company, and one of the head of the company says all the time, if you don't have any problem being on the 6 o'clock news, go for it. If I'm in a relationship that can't be on the 6 o'clock news, or that I can't walk down the street for the whole world to see, I probably don't belong in it. Okay? And when I'm in those relationships, I'm doing anything. And it doesn't even have to be that big a deal. But if I can't do it in front of the whole world, I need to be thinking about what I'm doing. And so when I look at it, and that's inconsiderate, and it's selfish, you know, because I'm worried about my feelings. My feelings have lied to me my whole life. Why am I all of a sudden worried about them? You know, it's, I think that somehow that they make me what I. But I always thought was, if that makes me feel good, I'll be good. I'll feel good. But it's never enough. It's never enough. I got to have more, and for more people. You know, that's the same circle again. But when I think about it now, it talks about, I tried to shape a sane and sound ideal of my future sex life or my future conduct. That ideal is what I've got to live up to, not what I expect another person to live up to. You know, it's like, yeah, if I can put my head on the pillow at night knowing that what I did was right, and I'm not going to attract things. That's the other part of this. You know, I'm not going to attract things that I'm going to have to explain later on if I'm living up to my ideal. This was an AA story too. There was a man that showed up at my door one night, and I did not invite him over. I didn't flirt with him or anything. And I said, no, you can't be here. I'm sorry. You need to leave. Didn't let him in. And I was on the telephone watch. And this guy's wife went back out. She went back out and drank. And I actually, she was a 12. She called that night. She didn't know I was on the 12-step list. And I'm talking to her. I'm trying to get some information. Get her. And she goes, I know who you are. You blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, and she thought I'd been messing around with her husband at one point. Yeah, I said, you know, at one time that might have been right in some place in my life, but it isn't now, and no, I didn't. And this conversation's ending. But it was funny because I thought, I could not stand up and say that a good part of my life. I beg your pardon. No, that's not who I am. I was ducking and weaving my whole life because of who I was. And that makes for a lot of drinking. Thanks, that's all I got.
All right. The police officer thing doesn't work for guys, just so you know. Well, I've never gotten it to work, so. Dang. One of the things that I love about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, my evolution. When I came into the rooms, I just had no concept of responsibility for my sex actions. After I did my sex inventory, I then, you know, moved into the loathing and despising myself, because I looked, you know, when I first wrote my list, it was, you know, bragging rights, and then it turned into kind of disgust for myself for where I had been. And, you know, today is a much healthier aspect for myself. But one of the things that I needed somebody else's insight to see was when I was 19, I had an affair with a married person, 54 years old, while their spouse was dying of cancer. And I did not see that I had done anything wrong, because I wasn't cheating on anybody, you know, or any of those things. I was doing nothing wrong. And my sponsor at the time said, you've inadvertently hurt somebody else that's dying of cancer, whether they ever find out about it or not. And that's when the guilt started laying in about my part in my sex behavior, and realizing that those little things that I didn't think was a problem, one-night stands, you know, never saw the person again, you know, no big deal. They were doing the same thing that I was doing. We were consenting adults, and realizing that for me that wasn't okay anymore. Where I was in my life and in my sobriety, that was no longer okay for me to, you know, that tornado we talk about, you know, spinning my tornado and, you know, impacting other people. And, you know, when we talk about the conduct over the years past, selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, who had we heard did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? And I said in the previous paragraph that that was my goal in using that. I wanted you to be jealous. I wanted you to be suspicious. I wanted you to be bitter. I wanted you to love me more. And it was all about me. It was all about how I wanted you all to be. And so today, I said it earlier, but God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. And I'm going to tell you all something that's an amazing thing that I tell myself all the time. I'm human. And sometimes I can fall back into that old behavior. And I start doing that. And when Jill was talking, I was remembering I was about 12 years sober. And in a committed, monogamous, honest relationship. And I was out of town at an assembly. And the wait staff started flirting back and forth, and you know, it really felt good to get that attention. You know, my ego was being brushed, and you know, my mind was immediately going to all of the places where my sexual ideal was no longer. So my sexual ideal's here, and then all of a sudden I'm over here giving my phone number. What? I'm insane. I mean, that's not who I want to be. And I had the whack in the back of the head that evening, and I'm like, oh my God, God, please help me with this, because I have now put myself into a situation. You know, we talked about it a little bit earlier, all of my own making. And, you know, I had to ask God for help, and God let me see clarity in that moment. That is not who you want to be today. And I was able to kind of pull back and apologize to this person and say, hey, I'm in a committed relationship, really love the compliments, but you know, that's not where I can go. And it was a hard conversation that my fear picked up and I didn't want to have, but I had to have it, because again, that wouldn't have been fair to that other person. I was flirting back too. So that's thank you again. Once again, thank you for help guiding me. That's what I have. Thanks.
Okay, we are running short on time. I'm going to read the last two paragraphs, and then if you guys want to have a couple of remarks, maybe we got time for that. So we're going to continue on page 69. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. Excuse me. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Jill?
Okay. The only thing that I can say about this part of the inventory is it keeps talking over and over about God and prayer and God and prayer and soundness of mind. It's like if I want to do this, I can't play around with it. I got to look at what I'm throwing out there to people. And I'm responsible. I'm responsible for my sobriety. I'm responsible for my conduct. And what might be good and right for you may not be good and right for me. I can only tell when I'm uncomfortable inside. I can't wait for my sponsor to go, "You're uncomfortable inside. You must be doing something wrong." I have to get a little bit honest about it and be open. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? And then find out why I refuse to take care of myself. You know, a lot of my this kind of behavior is because I refuse to take care of myself and to address things that I'm seeking people, other people to fill these voids. And so if sex happens to be part of it, oh well. Well, I got to stop that. That's not soundness of mind. That's selfish and self-centered. Thanks. That's all I got.
Thanks, Jill.
And just reflecting on what I just said, I mean, that pretty much sums it up. When I get into that position where it's becoming troublesome, I ask God for help. And one of the other things that I practice as part of my Carrying the Message program is if I am attracted to somebody that has asked me to sponsor them in any shape or form, I help them find somebody that's going to be able to help them, because I've done that trick too, where, you know, that relationship between a sponsor and a sponsee gets very, very close. And, you know, that's not a healthy place for me to be. So that's something, and it says to create our own ideals, and that's part of my ideal is, you know, I don't need to sit at a bar looking at booze all night and think that I'm not going to be tempted. So I need to do the same thing in my sex relations and all the other aspects of my life. Thank you.
Thank you, Dre. All right, we are going to pass the basket. The seventh tradition says that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Nice and loud. Anybody? Anything going on in AA? Wake up! Thank you. Anybody else? This group coming up Friday, October 16th, and Saturday, October 17th, right here in this room. And that's Friday and a Saturday, okay? Not a Monday night. We've got Rich B. from Ocean City, Maryland, and Jerry W. from Raleigh, North Carolina. We'll start in here on Friday night at 6:30. Talk about a couple of topics. Have you out of here by 9:30 on Saturday. We'll start in here at 9 a.m. A couple topics, potluck lunch, if you wish. We'll have you out of here by 2:30 on Saturday. There's no registration for this. It's absolutely for fun and for free. But we're very excited about both of these speakers. There's some lovely pumpkin-colored flyers on the table over there. Please take them with you. Take them back to your groups and help us get the word out. All are welcome. It's an open event. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Newcomers, you are the reason we are here. Is there anyone here today in your first 30 days of sobriety? If we could just get your first name, we'd like to welcome you. First 30 days?
I'm Jerry, an alcoholic.
Jerry, welcome.
Justin,
an
alcoholic.
Justin, welcome.
I'm Peter, an alcoholic.
Peter.
Hey, Peter,
welcome back, Peter. Anybody else? Well, welcome. Please hang around after the meeting. Somebody will talk to you. Literature is available over there. Please see a home group member if you'd like to purchase a book. Sponsorship questions. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, there'll be a couple of home group members. Debbie and Stephanie will be up front. And if you just want to ask a question or want to know more about sponsorship, just come up and we'll be happy to talk to you. Anybody else in the home group would be happy to talk to you. So, smokers, hey, we got a dilemma. We usually provide a butt can, but we can't find our butt can out there anywhere. So I think we're all going to have to kind of scan the grounds on our way out. Maybe we could get a bag or something. I'd be happy to hike them out of here, but if everybody could kind of take a look around and see if there's any butts on the ground. We don't want to leave any trash for the church. Brad's volunteered a lovely comestible container. Thanks, Brad. And stay well away after the meeting. Stay well away from the church doors. We're not the only ones using the facility, so we'd like the nice people to be able to come and go without walking through smoke. All our meetings are audio recorded, and upcoming events can be found on our website, simpleactions.net. So in closing, can we thank Jill and Greg again? I'd like to thank everyone who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, which is on 22nd and Colonial. It's a nice little place. So that's that. That's that. Could I have a volunteer to read last two paragraphs on page 164? Thanks, Brad. Somebody hold it way up.
Brad, we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Okay. And after we say the Lord's Prayer, feel free to come thank Greg and Jill.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Cool. Thank you, brother.